Good evening.
Good evening.
My name is Richard Colmar, and I am the guest speaker. I can say this because I'm not Richard Colmar, and I am not the guest speaker. Thank you for that, Jean, via the Diamond Sutra. When the head teacher, Kokyo Henkel, first approached me about talking to you, I had misgivings. Not just because I'm not the world's greatest public speaker, nor because my understanding of Buddha Dharma is broad, but perhaps not very deep. But mainly, I think, because I'm a foolish man, you know, who's done many foolish things and is acquiring wisdom very slowly. But at length, I decided to that I couldn't, in good conscience, not come before you because. Not only was it arrogant, really, not to take a chance, but selfish, but also because I know that everybody, no matter how foolish, no matter how ordinary, has something to give, and also because you never know. When the word that comes out of your mouth goes right into somebody's heart and changes their life. And I'll give you an example of that, which Bonnie was kind enough to remind me of on the way over in the car. She reminded me that about, it must be, 10 years now, I was invited to participate in a weekend workshop at Stanford University. The topic was walking as a spiritual practice. I have a little bit of a reputation as a walker. I like to walk. I've walked a lot and some pretty long distances. And because of the kind of walking I've done, which included a famous pilgrimage route, in Japan, which I'll tell you more about later, a professor at Stanford read something about me somewhere and got in touch and said, would you like to do this? And fool that I was, I agreed. Then it struck me, Stanford University. This is not just any old university. This is one of the top universities in the country. I looked at the names of the other people who were participating, and I knew I was out of my depth totally. I was terrified. I didn't know how I could possibly do it. I worked myself into a state beforehand, and by the time I actually arrived. Oh, by the way, Bonnie and I walked from here to Stanford for that event. It seemed fitting somehow, and people were amazed and intrigued by the fact that I would actually spend a couple of days walking from Santa Cruz to Palo Alto to talk in front of a bunch of people at a university. So by the time I actually arrived in the amphitheater at 9 o'clock in the morning or whenever it was, I was exhausted and confused, and I had terribly over-prepared. I had 100 pages of notes and all kinds of stuff. I'd spent weeks typing up all this stuff and going over and over and over. I got up in front of the people and my mind just went blank. And I have no idea to this day what happened. But Bonnie said, you did great at the end. And everybody clapped. People came up to me afterwards and wanted to talk to me. And then we did some events later that involved actually walking together, which was wonderful, something I really like to do. And but the most amazing thing, result, came months later when I heard from a man, a Vietnamese gentleman, a computer scientist, I think, who had been present, heard what I said, really got it, I described in the course of this talk a pilgrimage that I did in Japan called the Shikoku Hachiju Hachikasho, the 88 holy places of Shikoku. And he understood why that experience had changed my life. And he quit his job and went to Shikoku and did the pilgrimage. And it changed his life, just as it had mine. So you never know. You never know. And Kokyo said to me that I should tell you a little bit about myself. And I think he encouraged me to do this because he felt like I would, like my particular range of experience would make me kind of an interesting part of the mix here at the Zen Center. Some of you already know me slightly as the Tuesday and Friday noon Doan. I've been doing that for a while. I guess it's been about a year now since I started doing the Doan thing. And some of you have walked with me in the Santa Cruz Mountains or in Marin County, where I developed a pilgrimage route from Spirit Rock Meditation Center to Green Gulch Farm, which I hope to do again before I die. And I hope that some of you will walk with me again. I'll give you a little idea about my Dharma background. I was born and raised in New York City, and I was still living there when I first contacted Zen in the form of a monk from Ryutakuji named Sakiyama Sogen, who was a native of Okinawa. He was a student of Yamamoto Genpo and Nakagawa Soen Roshis, you might recognize those names. They were the teachers of Tai Shimano, who founded the New York Zen Center. And Sogen was a slightly older contemporary of Edo Shimano. And he was also a highly accomplished practitioner of the style of karate that I was then training in. And something about him impressed me, and I started sitting with him several mornings a week at a karate dojo that was a convenient short run across Central Park from the place where I was living at that time. And although we got along really well, it wasn't a particularly auspicious start to my Dharma career, because I used to show up hungover fairly often. And in fact, once or twice, I think I was still drunk from the night before. And though not conspicuously so, you know. He tolerated my behavior, and I kept sitting with him as many mornings a week as I could pull myself together. His English was very limited. My Japanese was non-existent, and I knew nothing about Zen except that it was a spiritual, a contemplative discipline, and that it emphasized sitting cross-legged. During a brief period of his residence in the USA, Sakiyama Sensei taught me the posture of sitting, the Heart Sutra, of which I understood not a word, and the Four Vows. And one other thing that I can remember, there were probably other things, but it was the idea of not getting stuck, not letting your mind get stuck, which I later realized was a translation of the term non-abiding mind. And it was very useful concept, both on the Zafu and on the mat. Because if you stop to think, you're gone. If you're fighting. So that's all I could remember of what he. I can remember of what he taught me, but it planted a seed. And the most interesting thing, looking back, was that he. Before he left, he didn't stay very long. He predicted that I would become a priest, which struck me as very funny at the time. Better? Okay. But he was serious, and much to my surprise, 10 years later, I was in Los Angeles studying Buddhism and preparing for ordination under another Rinzai Zen master, this time of Vietnamese lineage, that incorporates, among other things, the practice of Nembutsu. Anybody who doesn't know what Nembutsu is? It is the practice of reciting the name of Amitabha Buddha or some other Buddha or Bodhisattva. There are various forms of it, but that's the most popular is Amitabha. And the typical Rinzai Zen of East Asia, of Korea and China and Vietnam, as opposed to Japan, is that it's doctrinally very broad and often incorporates other practices than Zen. And the teacher who I ordained with was a professor of philosophy at UCLA, and he also taught Asian studies at Los Angeles City College. And he encouraged us to study the full range of the Buddhist teachings and to practice whatever Dharma gate we were most drawn to. So, and I was actually having trouble with Zen at that time. Although I found the Mahayana scriptures very beautiful and awe-inspiring, I needed a more structured approach and I think a more practical kind of guidance than they provided. And as for the Bodhisattva vows, they then struck me as quite beyond my capacity to envision, much less fulfill. So I began to cast about for an alternative beyond, you know, that... to what I viewed as an impossibly high road. No sooner had I ordained than Dr. Chenan died. I think I started studying there in the late 70s. I was ordained in June of 79, and he died in November of 80. And the place fell apart. Basically, there was a power struggle, and a group of us decided to leave. And I ended up in a Sri Lankan monastery. I'd already begun studying the applications of mindfulness, or Satipatthana, as it's known in Pali, under a group different teachers. I studied with Puniji and Shinzen Young and Usilananda, among others, and. Living in a Theravada monastery gave me a chance to focus on a close reading of important texts and to pick up a lot of practical experience. So after about 10 years of training in Satipatthana and about a dozen years as a monk, I found myself facing an unsettling reality. I had to admit that the comforts and the what Kabat-Zinn calls the full catastrophe of the householder's life still beckoned to me. I felt there was some treasure there that I wanted to explore. I wasn't ready to give it up. I had thought when I became a monk that I would, you know, that I would be a monk for life. But in the end, I decided that, well, for one thing, I didn't really, the concept of nirvana, of getting out, was receding from me instead of getting closer. I understood it less and less as I got older. And the whole death and rebirth thing was also becoming problematical. And in the end, I think, although it wasn't simply that I wanted samsara with the maximum upgrade, I wanted to be around ordinary people again and try and work with that. That would be my practice. I was also beginning to do more and more walking and spending more and more time as a pilgrim, and that meant less and less time in the monastery. And I knew from having watched others in a similar situation that if I spent too much time away from the supportive atmosphere of the monastery and the community of monks, that I was, you know, I was dead meat as far as being a monk was concerned. Sooner or later, I would slip. And so rather than do that, I decided to disrobe. But I had a lot invested in being a monk. And I was, the decision to disrobe was very painful. And I was beginning to question everything. My life was becoming rapidly hellish. And at that very moment, I think I was in Taiwan at the time. And I was invited by the head monk of a monastery in Japan to spend some time there, to come and visit. So I decided to go for it. And it turned out to be a place that was a small monastery, kind of in the spirit of a Kodo Sawaki style practice, where there was basically a lot of sitting and not much of anything else. And there I was, a complete mess, and sitting a minimum of 6 periods a day. And my mind was all over the place. And I couldn't pull it together at all. So I decided, since the instruction there was very, emphasized posture a lot, that I thought, well, I said to myself, even if you can't meditate, you can still sit. You see the mistake there, I hope. That, you know, I still thought of sitting as something different from zazen. I didn't get zazen at all. I was trying to. I'd been so well trained as a practitioner of satipatthana in this kind of step by step method with lots of protocols and lots of check-ins and all of this adjustments and stuff, that the idea of just letting it all go, it was totally beyond my capacity to grasp. When we were given instructions in, you know, I was still operating on the assumption that when you sat down on the cushion, you had a task to perform, right? That you had a skill to develop. There was something that you had to do. And when we were given instructions in posture, I actually asked at the end, and then what do you do? And Sakyamuni Roshi said, nothing. And then another Western monk who was there said, but what about the breath? And he had in mind, I think, that aren't you supposed to watch your breath or count your breaths or something? And I will never forget what he said in response. He said, let the Buddha breathe. Oh. Let the Buddha breathe. I carried that around for years, and it has proved come in very handy at times. Anyway, that was when I reconnected with Zen. But it was a different Zen than I had known previously. I did go on to disrobe a few years later. and I have no regrets at all. In 1993, I circumambulated the island of Hokkaido with a group of environmental and peace activists and some indigenous people, and the group included half a dozen Buddhist monks too, and we lived out of dumpsters, and we lived on donations, and we walked all the way around the island of Hokkaido, and it was just a few months before the big Hokkaido earthquake, and the tunnel that we had walked through a few months before collapsed. But we were long gone, I'm happy to say. And I got to see up close and personal the great Asian crane, which is really a magnificent sight. That was worth any amount of suffering. And there was some suffering on that trip. And then a few years after that, 1995, 50th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I decided that in preparation for visiting those cities, I would do something special, and at length I decided that I would walk the 88 holy places, which if you do all the unnumbered temples that are strongly recommended, it comes out to 108 temples. It's the circumference of the island. Actually, you're going up into the mountains, back down to the sea, and then up and back and up and back, in a kind of a beautiful flower pattern almost around the island. And you're constantly doing puja, in effect. So it's like pujas within pujas within pujas. It's a huge ceremony. And later, actually, I was invited to Stanford again to participate in a seminar on Buddhist ritual, and the pilgrimage on Shikoku is, among other things, a gigantic ritual practice that takes, well, depending on how, let's see, you can do it. Thank you. You can do it probably in 4 or 5 weeks if you were very, very fast and had no concern for actually seeing anything. But it normally would take 6 or 7 weeks to do, I would say. And I can't remember the exact number of days that I took, but I dawdled and took my time, although I walked on average at least 20 miles a day. But there were short days and long days. You know, some days you could see a whole bunch of temples in just a few hours, and then on other days you would have to walk 30 or 40 miles between temples. But there were places to stay almost everywhere, so that you didn't have to carry any bedding or anything like that. You stayed in hostels or in temples. You paid a nominal fee and you got to sleep in a dormitory with the hundreds of other people. And every morning you got up and there was a service, that the temple priest would give a service, and very often a fire ceremony. Most of the temples are Shingon temples, the esoteric Buddhism, and they like to do goma, they call it. It's a modern esoteric variant of the ancient Vedic fire ceremony, and it's quite electrifying when it's done really well, especially the Shugendo version, the outdoor version, which is done with a big bonfire and lots of big drums. It's like taiko drumming and chanting, very, very forceful, very macho chanting. So anyway, then after I completed the Shikoku 88, I then took the ferry to Kyushu and did some more walking on Kyushu, and arrived at Nagasaki just before my visa was up, a three-month visa. So I basically walked for 3 months. And that's a powerful experience, walking for 3 months, just going to bed at night, exhausted, getting up, eating breakfast, chanting, walking, eating, sleeping, walking, eating, sleeping, walking, and being outside almost all the time. That's one of the reasons why it's so powerful is because except for meals and bath, you're outside all the time, every day of your life. Just as we were for how many hundreds of thousands of years before we learned how to build houses and stuff. When we weren't in the cave, we were outside. Yeah, it changes all the time. Japan gets a lot of rain, and it gets rain in every season. The nicest weather, the most beautiful weather, is the spring and the fall. Summers are hot and humid, and winters are cold, and depending on where you are, they can be either very rainy or very snowy. And but another thing that makes it so powerful is that you're going into the mountains. In other words, you're gaining elevation. It's sometimes quite a lot of elevation. And then coming back down to sea level and walking some more and going back up. So, and the period, the time scale is long, yeah? It's you're talking about months. So the seasons are changing while you walk, but they're also changing as you gain and lose altitude. So you get cherry blossoms in the lower altitudes first, and then you get them later in the higher altitudes, so that you follow. And oh, when I started out in the spring, I started just before the vernal equinox. I climbed Mount Koya, which is the seat of Kobodaishi Kukai Shonin's monastery in the Kii Peninsula, in the mountains. And I paid homage there, and I came down, and it was snowing on Koya-san when I started. It was snowing. And when Shikoku's a little warmer, so it was sleet and cold rain the first week or two. And then the temperatures gradually grew milder, and and depending on where I was, it was warmer or colder. And I watched them planting the rice. And by the time I finished, at the end, the rice was turning golden. And had I gone around again, I would have gotten to see the harvest as well. You know, so that's something. And then you're walking through history, too. You're walking in a path that people have been walking for many hundreds of years. Probably, you know, 1,000 years, conservatively. And you're walking through... Oh, is it something very strange? Let me check the time. Okay, I've got a few more minutes. And interesting. How people can be... The various ways in which we can be present to each other. I've been thinking about that a lot lately because... Bonnie's father died recently. Catherine died recently. This is Catherine's seat. You know, it's still Catherine's seat, even though Catherine is still here, even though she's not here, right? So when we're all facing the wall in Zazen, where am I? Where are you? Where are we to each other? You know, these are the kind of questions. And how do we keep connecting, even when we're not? When we're not talking to each other, when we're not looking at each other. And, you know, it's one of the things I think that measures our Zazen somehow, is how connected we feel to each other when we're alone on our Zafus. You know. Anyhow, Kobodaishi lived in the early 9th century. He walked around Shikoku. A lot of the places, the temples claimed to have been founded by him. Spots, they're associated with spots where he performed miracles or had some enlightenment experience or something like that. Anyway, I of course read about Kobodaishi, and I read his writings before I went on the pilgrimage, and I did my homework, so I was ready for that. But what I wasn't ready for was Kobodaishi himself. Most of the temples had stories associated with Kobodaishi, and you heard them or read them when you got there. Somebody would tell you, or you would see a plaque that told a story about him, or you would read about it in the guidebook. And there was a statue of Kobodaishi everywhere, and there was a shrine to Kobodaishi where you went to offer prayers at every temple. And that was part of the ceremony of the pilgrimage itself, is that you recited the Heart Sutra at every temple, and you recited the mantra of Kobodaishi at every temple. And along the roadside there were shrines to Kobodaishi, and there were statues of Kobodaishi. In the middle of nowhere, in the mountains, you'd suddenly be standing in front of Kobodaishi. Somebody had put a statue out there, miles from any place. And after a while, you start feeling like you know the guy. You know, you've read so much about him, and he starts becoming real in an entirely different way. He's no longer just a historical figure. He's somebody who's alive in the place. You know, he's part of the fabric of nature almost there. And that whole boundary between the seen and the unseen starts to give way somehow. That's part of the power of that kind of experience. And so naturally having done that and having been so strongly affected by it, I wanted to keep doing it. So when I came back here and I realized there were all these centers in the Santa Cruz Mountains, I headed down here with my backpack to see if I could talk them into letting me stay over, and I started walking around. And I put together a course that goes through the Santa Cruz Mountains, starting down at Mount Madonna, and go all the way up to Jikoji. You know, most of you probably know Jikoji at the other end, and there are 7 or 8 Dharma centers in between. And if you, the logistics are a little complicated, but you can work out a way that you can stay in one center almost every night. And it's a wonderful walk. It's a little long. It's about 100 miles. But it's doable. Bonnie and I did it once together, and I've done it with a few other people. And one leg of it, between Lama Tarchin's place and Land of Medicine Buddha, I still do from time to time. And anybody who would like to come along, I would be happy to show you the way. So that's probably enough. If anybody has a question or a comment or anything, I'm happy to hear what you have to say. Yeah.
I was wondering, as you were talking, you said that you were, at one point you were struggling so much with sitting. I'm wondering why you decided to keep sitting. You know, that was so, what drew you to it, even though it was such a...
it was an unpleasant experience. Oh, yes, very unpleasant. Yeah, every time I sat down, it was as though every sin of commission or omission, everything I'd done that was even the slightest bit off, you know, in my entire life, came up for review. It was just endless. The legions of Mara, you know. And I think I decided to sit because, in part, because I couldn't think of anything else to do. I was out of options, you know. And also I felt that whatever it was, no purpose would be served by running away from it. And there was something about the posture of sitting, you know. The posture, there's a reason why we're taught to sit this way. And it's because it gives us a kind of strength that we don't normally have. It's stable, it's upright, it connects the heaven and the earth. And of course we're taught that it's the posture that the Buddha sat in. So we borrow some of his courage and some of his intellect when we sit, some of his insight, and we try to let the Buddha breathe and let the Buddha sit, and try to let. And the amazing thing was that after a couple of months of struggling, not with my mind, but with my posture, you know, just trying to sit and trying to be straight, trying to be stable, upright, balanced. You know, I even developed an acronym for it: RUBS, relaxed, upright, balanced, stable. And I just rehearsed that again and again. I felt like that was what was keeping me from going crazy. But then the posture took care of everything. And one day I realized that my mind had stopped doing that. Not only had my mind calmed down, but I was completely content just to be sitting there breathing in and out. I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to be anybody. I had nothing to prove, nothing to accomplish, nothing at all. I was completely content for the first time in my life. And as soon as I realized that, I just began to weep. And I wept for days afterwards. Days. The other monks thought I was crazy. You know, something, what's happening to you? They said, what's going on? I said, oh, it's great. It's great. I feel great. You know. And I hadn't done anything. You know, I hadn't done anything. So, that's... Anyway, that opened the door to Zazen for me. That experience in that place where I got to sit six periods in the morning and six periods at night. That was our regular daily practice. So I had a lot of... But the aching knees was fine. Much better than the torture of my own mind. Okay, probably enough. Oh, yes, please.
It begs the question, finding that kind of peace, why would you disrobe?
In part because I wanted to see if I could hold it in any kind of situation. And there is something a little bit, you know, artificial about the monk's life. And the Buddha knew that perfectly well. That was the whole point. It's a safe space. It's a safe space in which your needs are met, your basic needs are met. And there's a regular schedule, and you don't have anything to do except stay on the case. You know, that's all you have to do. All the other responsibilities are relieved. So, you know, that's why I think some teachers have said, you know, small effort, small enlightenment, big effort, big enlightenment. And there's no question. The Buddha knew perfectly well that the householder's life is a lot harder to express your Buddha nature in the householder's situation than in the monks. And the kind of practice that we do is really a householder's practice, and it's a hard practice because we have to go to work and we have to love each other and live with the moments when we don't love each other. We can't love each other. That's part of our practice. It's a wonderful, amazing thing about Dogen Zen is that it, because the things, the myriad things, advance to affirm the self, to illuminate the self. Everything is included in the practice. There's no outside the practice, you know. And we can't escape, you know, from the practice. But the other thing I would add to that is that the monastery, there are plenty of demons in the monastery too. And you can find, if you want a demon, you can find one in the monastery without any problem. And I knew plenty of guys who were cranky monks and tormented monks. And, you know, one fellow drove himself mad because he couldn't get enlightened. You know, that's not an uncommon thing, especially in the Rinzai side, you know. One of Hakuin Zenji's disciples attempted suicide more than once because he couldn't pass a koan. You know, I'm not sure I altogether sympathize with that, but But I can understand it, you know, that the demons are there, and we can abuse anything, and even Dharma practice. You know, we can make Dharma practice into a kind of torture too, or a kind of, you know, substance abuse. We can try to escape ourselves in Dharma practice. But that's harder, I think, in Dogen Zen than in some other forms of practice, because we don't concentrate in the same sort of way. Our practice is not about narrowing but the focus, but of opening up the focus, you know, including everything. Everything. I mean, we are ultimately everything. And I suppose if I really wanted to give a full account of myself, I would end up talking about the billions and billions of stars, like Carl Sagan, because, you know, we're the universe organized itself into us somehow, you know. So enough, I think. Oh, yo, did you want to ask a question? Sorry. Okay. So, I just.
Oh,
yes.
Incorporate,
yes.
Other sects of Buddhism in.
Yeah, he was very generous in that way.
Was that echoing when you did the exploration of Satipatthana and then your walking meditation? Did that keep with you? Or
oh, sure, yes. I think it was very, it was really formative. Dr. Tianan was a scholar, a very, very learned man who had studied many things besides Zen. And then one of the teachers, meditation teachers at our center in Los Angeles, also gave me a kind of a sense that it was okay to explore and okay to tinker, you know, with your practice, that that the worst thing, again, the same theme, the worst thing that could happen was to get stuck somewhere, you know. And if you get stuck, you try different stuff. And that's okay. And I feel deeply grateful to those teachers for that, for giving me permission to be interested in more than one thing. you know, there's a lot to be said for focusing on one thing, too. That's what I'm trying to do now. Since I came here. Had enough?
Thank you.
Okay. Things are numberless. I vow to save him. Reasons are unsolved.